Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg running for president. The school city of Hammond has a new superintendent. Lauren Chapman reports on the gaming bill passing the House. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Bob Crumweed, CEO of Regional Health Systems. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg officially announced that he is running for president. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingart reports the move comes after Buttigieg spent nearly 4 months testing the waters with an exploratory committee.
More than 4,500 supporters crammed into the freezing cold and leaking former Studebaker plant on Sunday to hear Buttigieg officially declare that he'd seek the Democratic nomination.
I recognize the audacity of doing this as a Midwestern millennial mayor. More than a little bold, at age 37, to seek the highest office in the land.
If elected, Buttigieg would check a lot of firsts. The first openly gay president, the first mayor, and the youngest. Three other mayors gave speeches before Buttigieg. One was West Sacramento, California Mayor Christopher Cabaldon.
Pete Buttigieg is the Maltese-American, left-handed, Episcopalian, gay millennial war veteran that America didn't know we needed.
In addition to those inside, more than 1,500 waited outside, where Buttigieg spoke first before coming inside to make his announcement. Still others sought shelter from the rain and watched a live stream of the event in nearby restaurants or the public library. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana's last remaining public school that's only for girls will be going co-ed starting this fall. The conversion of the Franklin Woods McCullough Academy for Girls in Gary into a co-ed school was approved last week by the Distressed Unit Appeals Board, which oversees the Gary Community School Corporation. District Emergency Manager Pete Marekas says the change at the Gary School could attract back families who may have left for other area district and charter schools to keep their boys and girls in school together. The Times reports the district has heard from parents who sent their children to the school specifically because it's all girls. In response, district officials are considering offering co-ed classes and single-gender classes for boys and girls at the school. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The president of the University of Notre Dame says the school will donate $100,000 toward the renovation of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris following a devastating fire. The Reverend John Jenkins announced the donation Tuesday, a day after the fire destroyed the cathedral's spire and roof. On Tuesday evening, the bells of the Basilica of the Sacred Heart on the university's campus in South Bend tolled 50 times to represent the 50 Hail Marys of the Rosary and to mark the start of the cathedral rebuilding. Jenkins says the cathedral's, quote, exquisite Gothic architecture has for centuries raised hearts and minds to God. He goes on to say, we join in prayer with the faithful of the cathedral and all of France as they begin the work of rebuilding. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. An Indiana man who pleaded guilty in Chicago federal court to an alleged scheme that involved his recycling firms reselling hazardous electronic waste has been sentenced to 3 years in prison. The Chicago Tribune reports Brian Brundage was given his punishment Thursday after pleading guilty last year to wire fraud and tax evasion. He also was ordered to pay nearly $1.3 million in restitution. The Dyer man told the court he understands and accepts responsibility for his actions. Brundage owned the Chicago Heights-based Intercon Solutions, Inc. and EnviroGreen Processing in Gary, Indiana. Prosecutors say he falsely told his clients that his companies were recycling electronic waste such as video display components and that it was being handled in an environmentally friendly way. Some ended up being sold to buyers overseas. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Hammond School Board voted 4-1 to approve his contract on Tuesday night. Trustee Carlotta Blake King was the lone opposition vote. His hire drew loud cheers from the audience, many who worked with him at the Career Center and came to show support. The Post Tribune reports Miller told the board, quote, "Your trust in me is not in vain. I really look forward to working alongside you to just bring the best possible schools in Hammond that we can." He goes on to say that can't just happen from the superintendent. It's going to require all of us. After the vote, he gathered the crowd, mostly school employees, into a large group picture. Miller, who has never been a school superintendent, was granted a 5-year temporary superintendent license by the Indiana Department of Education on March 26. He has been the Career Center's principal since 2016. Miller started as an information technology teacher there in 2000. Miller also spent 2 years as dean of students at Lake Ridge New Tech Schools before returning to Hammond in 2016. Miller starts the position immediately. His 3-year contract pays $150,000 annually plus benefits. Current Superintendent Walter Hawkins will stay on until his retirement in June.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A new round of testing has found lead levels in the drinking water at 7 Hammond schools that exceed the federal action level for the toxic metal. The School City of Hammond's board heard from a consulting firm Tuesday that drinking water in the 7 schools and 2 other district buildings tested above the EPA's lead action level of 15 parts per billion. The new testing follows tests conducted last summer that led the district to remove 15 drinking fountains from service in 9 schools. The Times reports the district is preparing a report on its response to the test results. Exposure to even low levels of lead can damage a child's developing brain, affecting their IQ, ability to pay attention, and academic achievement.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
1 week after the unexplained firing of a deputy clerk who oversaw the water department, the new Chicago Town Council has voted to hire a town manager. In a 4-1 vote April 16th, the town council voted to establish a town manager position. The town manager will oversee all of the town services in an effort to increase transparency and efficiency. Public comment wasn't allowed at the special meeting, and one man angrily left after his attempt to speak was rejected. Council President Sharon Sueto said the town needs someone to fill the void left by Sue Pelfrey's firing April 8th by Clerk Treasurer Lori Colmar. Councilmember Pam Richard voted against establishing the new position. Sueto said other towns and cities with managers run smoothly. Town attorney Lloyd Mullen read the ordinance establishing the town manager job that included several duties, including serving as a liaison between citizens and the town council. The council told Colmar to advertise for the position that will pay $40,000 annually and include 5 weeks of vacation. After the meeting, Colmar declined to talk about Pelfrey's firing. She referred questions to Miraville attorney Carrie Castro. Mullen said he's still puzzled about what triggered Pelfrey's termination. Pelfrey, a former town council member, said Colmar didn't give her a reason either.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Crown Point Fire Department's second charity dodgeball tournament raised more than $13,000 to benefit the Northwest Indiana Cancer Kids Foundation. The Post Tribune reports on Monday, firefighters presented the check to the NIC Foundation for an amount that topped last year's total of $10,714. The event at the Sparta Dome at Crown Point's Sportsplex featured 32 teams made up mostly of Northwest Indiana first responders, but also government officials and businesses, and drew over 450 attendees. NIC Executive Director Donna Kreider said they are celebrating 10 years as a foundation, having aided 166 families, and it could not have been done without the support of the community. The tournament is looking to add more teams next year and are also in need of referees. Any team that joins will have its work cut out for them, as the Hobart Police Department's Throwball Cops have won both tournaments.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Former U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan is joining the University of Notre Dame faculty and will be a guest lecturer in political science and economics. The school announced Monday that the Wisconsin Republican will discuss topics during the 2019-2020 academic year, including the fundamentals of American government, the current state of political polarization, and Catholicism and economics. Ryan didn't seek re-election last year. He'll be among other former lawmakers and government officials sharing real-world policy and political experience with students in Notre Dame. The school announced earlier this year that former Democratic U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly was returning to his alma mater as an instructor after losing his re-election bid. Dennis McDonnell, one of former President Barack Obama's top White House aides, earlier joined the school's international affairs program.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill responded to a federal lawsuit Monday filed by Whole Women's Health Alliance. The alliance has worked since 2017 to open an abortion clinic in South Bend. The alliance filed the lawsuit in March after the state last year denied the organization's application because it said the alliance did not provide necessary information about its other clinics around the country. The alliance argues the licensing requirements are too vague. In his response to the federal injunction, Attorney General Hill argues the alliance wants to be exempt from Indiana's abortion laws. Hill said in a statement, quote, "There is certainly nothing unreasonable nor unconstitutional about requiring abortion clinics to be licensed facilities." The alliance reapplied for the license in January.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Some parents of students with disabilities are raising concerns about testing accommodations as the state rolls out its new standardized exam. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports, they're demanding state policy changes.
Students start taking Indiana's new standardized test called iLearn this month. But the computer won't read directions allowed to students who need it, like with the iStep. Senator Erin Houchin's son has dyslexia. She says the state should take steps to ensure schools offer text-to-speech accommodations for students with a sight or reading disability.
I think it's, you know, bad enough if we're not providing it for the passages and the test questions, but now we're not even providing it for instructions.
A bill amended this week would push the state to make those changes. The Department of Education says reading directions allowed may be an easier
fix. You're listening
fix,
to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Speech technology for reading comprehension is more complicated. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana budget writers will have about $100 million less to work with than previously anticipated. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on a new revenue forecast unveiled Wednesday that helps determine what Indiana's new state budget will look like.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Sessions gaming bill passed the House Monday. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports many supporters say they want a number of changes to the final version of the bill.
A number of legislators had changes they would recommend as the House and Senate work out the differences between their two versions. One example, mobile sports betting. Terre Haute Representative Alan Morrison says while sports wagering is included in this version of the bill,
but I do believe that we're missing a major component of it, and that's the mobile part.
He says by not including mobile betting, Indiana falls behind the other eight states that have already legalized sports betting. Gaming is the fourth largest source of revenue for the state. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bill that would have expanded what consumer advocates call predatory lending practices died in the Indiana House Monday. Republicans had argued the bill would have created what they called a middle option between payday lending and traditional bank loans, but still with high interest rates. Proponents argued Hoosiers with bad credit have too few options for loans outside of payday lending. Opponents, such as the Indiana Institute for Working Families, had spoken out against the bill from its inception, and it only narrowly passed the Senate. They argued the interest rates were still too high, rates that, in some cases, would have been allowed to exceed the state's legal limits of 72%. When asked to bring his bill up for a third reading Monday, House sponsor Matt Lehman passed. Because Monday was the deadline for bills on third reading to be voted on, the legislation stops. Another bill that would have shrunk the state's payday lending interest rates by more than 90% died in the Senate right before the session's halfway point.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bill that seeks to give foster parents more of a voice passed the House unanimously Monday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports it makes several changes to the foster care system.
Among other changes, the measure creates a new definition of a long-term foster parent, someone who's cared for the child for at least 12 months. The bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Kevin Mahan, says this bill reorients Indiana's foster system.
We're going to put into code here anything that has to do with DCS, foster kids, whatever the case may be, must be in the best interest of the child.
The bill passed the House unanimously. It now goes back to the Senate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bill that would fund firearm training for teachers was amended Tuesday in the state Senate to require anyone authorized to carry a gun in a school to take part in a personality screening. School districts in Indiana already have the authority to arm teachers. This bill would require a teacher to spend time with a lawyer and mental health professional before being authorized to carry a weapon in school. Additionally, a teacher must complete 38 hours of specialized training and 8 hours of updated training each year. The bill passed out of the Senate Tuesday.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Lawmakers joined a crowd of public education supporters at a State House rally Tuesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports the group gathered to press for better school funding and teacher pay as the legislative session winds down.
While lawmakers in the Senate decided the fate of several bills, a group of public education advocates wearing red gathered downstairs. Teachers' unions, the Coalition for Public Education, and Indiana PTA helped organize the event as a near final push for more money in the state budget. Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick is Indiana's last elected schools chief. She told the crowd it's more important than ever to keep the pressure on elected officials.
But it is time we start asking our state, our federal, our local officials, where are you on teacher pay?
Lawmakers will work to finalize the budget by the end of next week. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Outstanding questions sidelined a bill in the legislature to tax vaping products. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports the bill sponsor feels confident the legislation will move forward this year.
The bill would create a 20% tax on vaping products and modify state law to restrict the sale of vaping products to minors. But during its second reading, lawmakers instead moved to study the issue during the summer. Senator Ed Charbonneau says questions remain about how to tax e-cigarettes, like should the device be taxed or the cartridges. Despite those, Charbonneau says the impact on Hoosier kids is a motivating factor for all lawmakers.
When you look at between 2011 and 2015, 900% increase in fifth graders.
If lawmakers can come to a consensus about the legislation, they may be able to send the bill to the governor by the end of this session. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance urged lawmakers at the State House Wednesday to continue funding a daily passenger train from Indianapolis to Chicago. The Hoosier State Amtrak line has received $3 million each year for the line. This funding was removed from this year's state budget. Senator Ron Alting tried to amend the rail line funding into the budget, but was not successful. He says the passenger rail is the future, not the past.
It's more energy efficient, cleaner, and it's safer. How many more reasons you can get?
The line has seen a decrease in ridership over the last several years, but supporters say they aren't given the funding to make improvements or market the service. A budget forecast released Wednesday projected $100 million less than originally predicted. Supporters of the Amtrak line say they're still hopeful.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The U.S. is a landing spot for thousands of people fleeing persecution, war, and violence. And that can trigger mental illness in many of these U.N.-sanctioned refugees. But getting help can be a challenge. Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis explains why.
Kizito Kalima was 14 years old at the start of the Rwandan genocide. Over just a few months in 1994, hundreds of thousands of Tutsi people were killed, including most of his family.
It's hard to understand. It's hard to understand if you never lived through it.
Kalima was bashed over the head with a machete, beaten up, and left in a ditch filled with dead bodies. He escaped into the jungle, where he lived for 3 months, eating grass and drinking swamp water.
It was just very shocking, and it took me a while to figure out what was going on.
I'm sitting with Kalima in his office at the Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation in Indianapolis. He came to the U.S. on a basketball scholarship after living as a refugee in East Africa. Now, the nonprofit he founded raises awareness of genocide and other human rights atrocities. It also connects immigrants and refugees to mental health resources.
Everybody who's been through any kind of civil war, any conflict, somehow, some way you have some sort of mental health issues.
Research shows the trauma many refugees suffer before coming to the U.S. and the difficulties they face starting over in a new country can cause anxiety, depression, and other mental health problems. Diane Mitschke of the University of Texas at Arlington says rates of post-traumatic stress disorder in refugees are especially high.
Sometimes as much as 10 times the rates that we see in a typical American population.
It's especially a problem for people who fled war-torn countries like Iraq, Syria, and Burma.
Previously, there were a lot of issues with the military in Burma, targeting and harming the people.
That's Chelsea Davey of Exodus Refugee Immigration. The Indianapolis-based organization settled more than 1,600 refugees in the city in the past 3 years. About half of all refugees resettled in Indianapolis come from Burma, also known as Myanmar.
There was a lot of forced labor, a lot of violence, a lot of loss of land.
Once in the U.S., the stresses continue. Refugees must adapt to new environments, languages, and cultures, which can impact mental health as much as living in a war zone. That's according to researcher Mengxi Zhen of Ball State University.
They probably think have a really good picture of the life in the U.S., but the situation is probably different as they thought.
And there are barriers to getting help. Sometimes it's a cultural issue. Refugees from countries without access to mental health professionals may not be aware of available treatment. Zhang says that contributes to a stigma.
And in some of the Asian countries, having mental health issue is considered as crazy or some even like worse words.
Research shows many refugees aren't even aware that they might have a mental illness. Instead of seeing a psychologist or psychiatrist, they come to a primary care doctor's office. Here's Mitschke of the University of Texas again.
So a patient might come in, you know, complaining of headaches or dizziness or even severe back pain.
But experts say it's important to remember not all refugees suffer from mental illness. Mitschke says refugees are resilient and lean on each other for comfort and support.
I think so much credit needs to be given to the refugees themselves who have lived that struggle and have learned about, how to navigate life here in the U.S. and then are able to pass that on to the newly arrived refugees.
Kalima, the immigrant from Rwanda, was eventually diagnosed with PTSD, and he's still grappling with memories of the genocide. Water dripping from a faucet reminds him of the months he spent in the jungle. Loud, violent action movies are another trigger.
You know, it's been 25 years. I'm still having nightmare, something I saw when I was a teenager.
But Kalima says his PTSD is under control, and he doesn't want to think of himself as a victim. He tells the refugees he works with that acting like a victim means your oppressors win. I'm Lauren Bavis, Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Bob Crumweed, CEO of Regional Health Systems.
Of Regional Health Systems, for folks that are not familiar with what the Head Start program is all about.
Geminis was formed in 1993 as a joint effort between South Lake Center for Mental Health and Tri-City Mental Health Center in East Chicago. We found a need to kind of try to curtail some of our administrative costs. And so together we put together Geminis to do all of our backroom stuff, housekeeping, human resources, our IT services, our electronic health record. And then in 1997, we had an opportunity to bid on the Head Start program, and we did that. And much to our surprise and pleasure, we were the successful bidder. And so we ran the Head Start program in Lake and Porter County and Stark County for the last 11 years. And so that's what got us kind of in the door in terms of early childhood education.
Where did Lake County finally fit into this now, since you mentioned you had these other other activities that were part of Geminis, and you've got involved with Head Start because of the contract that you were able to pick up outside of Lake County? Did you find that the success that you all had with the programs for Head Start in those other counties kind of lead into Lake County?
Well, we picked them all up at the same time.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I may have misspoke there, but yes, we picked all three counties up at the same time.
When people think of Head Start, is there anything in particular that they and then maybe it's when you find this out too, when you get people that decide to come in and they need the extra help, they have young family members that need to get a good start in their education, and we're talking about, you know, almost toddlers, I suppose, right, and the age?
Actually, with Head Start, we start with kids as early as 2 years old, but
wow.
For the vast majority of them are 4 and 5 year olds, and like every 4 and 5 year old, there's a need for early exposure to learning and educational stimulus. If they don't get that appropriately and in frequent enough volume, then they really suffer when they start school and they have to catch up. What we find is the kids that go through Head Start actually start ahead of all the other kids that go into kindergarten, and they maintain that lead up to about third grade, which is wonderful. So we're taking kids that need that additional stimulus, giving it to them early on, and they not only perform even with the other kids that came perhaps from higher income areas with, you know, two parent as opposed to one parent families, things of that nature, but they exceed in their performance in early education.
Is there something about Head Start that gives the youngsters the advantage that they get when they do go into pre-K or go into kindergarten?
It's just the attention that the teachers give them, you know, and our teachers all have some advanced education preparation. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, we bring the parents along with us, you know, and so most of these parents want to do right, not most of them, all these parents want to do right by their children. And so we show them ways to stimulate them at home, too, in terms of wanting to learn. And it works out great for everybody.
Now, part of the Geminis Head Start program is what is, I guess, formerly known as the St. Mark Center, which is based in Gary. Tell us a little bit about the center, because it's this we're talking today about the expansion, which is sure. Really major. But how did the St. Mark program get started there?
Well, we've been looking for a good site to expand our services in the Civil City of Gary. We've always had a classroom in St. Mark's Church there, and when the church when it became apparent that the church was probably going to vacate that site, we made an inquiry to them as to would we be able maybe to acquire the building that's right across the street from the chapel there.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, they were quite eager to to part ways with it and help us because we, you know, had the same kind of mission. And so we bought it. We did a pretty respectable renovation in addition to it. And we're now serving kids out of there full time. And it allowed us to increase our census by about 200 kids this year.
Wow. So you have about 200 more than what you had before. How many did
all total?
How many were in the other, just the single facility
before
you moved?
I could tell you for sure how many were in the single. I know we had one class that was about 26 kids probably. I think the building we have there now probably has about 100 kids in it. Mm-hmm. We treat 1,500 kids system-wide.
Now tell us, with all of this expansion, you know, and you have this extra room and you're taking the best advantage of it, what are you offering now for the young people that come in there at St. Mark's?
Well, again, you know, we give them a structured curriculum, help them do things like learn their numbers, basic things like how to put their own shoes on, how to behave in a civil way with their classmates. It's a disciplinary issue that gives them all the tricks and talents and patience that a kid needs when they go into kindergarten. It works quite well.
Do they have the advantage now, I guess, when the weather's nice, to get out and do more things where maybe that they might not have had before?
Absolutely, and all of our sites have an outdoor playground.
Right.
So that works really well, too.
What do the youngsters that get involved in the program think, and maybe more importantly, what do their parents think about the early childhood education they get? The young people are probably just enjoying what's happening in the classroom, but the parents are more concerned about what kind of impact it's going to have on their youngsters in the future, I imagine.
Well, yeah, but both of them enjoy the fact that, you know, the kids picking up the tools they're going to need for further education, and it's infectious. I mean, if you go in there and you watch these kids, it makes your whole day, and it does their parents too. They enjoy seeing their kids interact with other kids in an appropriate manner. And for a lot of kids, this is the only opportunity they have to have social interactions with children their own age. It's hard these days. With, you know, almost everybody has to work at least two jobs if you're a single parent, or both of you have to work if you're not, at a minimum. So it's difficult to give your kid that kind of socialization on the few hours you have available in between. And this provides it.
We're talking with Bob Crumweed, who is the CEO of Regional Health Systems. We're talking here first about the expansion of the St. Mark's facility, Geminis Head Start in Gary. And they have double the space now, I guess, as you had to work with before,
it's,
I imagine.
It's probably four times the space.
Oh, four times,
before,
even much bigger than that, too. We've talked here just briefly about the overall regional health system here in Lake County and Porter and LaPorte counties. What does the rest of the services that the organization offer that has allowed for this expansion in particular? People maybe drive by a facility and they don't even see one, especially if they're looking at the facility that's located in here in Maryville.
Yeah, we've got a plethora of locations. We provide a wide range of services too. At Geminis, we obviously, our early childhood education is home there. And in addition to working with the Head Start program, we also work with other child care providers in the area for them to increase their and improve their curriculum in terms of the way they treat their the kids that are in their care. And the state actually provides them with some additional money through our child care vouchers that we also are responsible for doling out. If that child care provider brings on extra staff and works at improving their curriculum, they get a few extra dollars per year to treat the kids in their care. And so it's a four-level system. So if you go to a child care provider, you want to look for somebody that's at a three or a four level. Mm-hmm. And that means that they're paying attention and they have a good curriculum for the kids that they're treating. And we also actually provide them with supervision around that.
Do you find that your organization is offering a lot more assistance to the, not only locally but to the state of Indiana? They like to expand and make sure that their services that they have are the best, and you're kind of augmenting them, or you're certainly helping them out in their programs?
To some degree, that's true, yes. Yeah. And in fact, we've got a grant in right now to maybe provide some consultation to sites and services outside of the area that we serve right now, but that won't ripen for another month or two.
we focus here, I guess, mainly on the Department of Child Services. And in fact, we've just had our conversation with Tammy Silverman with IYI about that. Do you find that with through your organization that you're helping not only deal with the issues of child abuse and neglect as well as early childhood education?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, part of the regional health system family is Regional Mental Health Center, which is the combination of Tri-City and Southlake. And we do a lot of work with DCS there for mm-hmm. kids that have been referred to us for a variety of problems. You know, sometimes it's just truancy. Other times there's abuse and neglect. Sometimes there's a terrible behavior problem. And we help with a therapy that puts those kids, keeps those kids in the community and helps get them back on the right track. And we do a lot of work just with parents and children where there's a lot of, you know, conflict in terms of the relationship there. So that works out really well for us also.
So obviously, Child Abuse Prevention Month is certainly an important month for you all, as well as it is for IYI and even DCS, I imagine.
Absolutely. And before I forget, we're going to have a candlelight vigil tonight on the square in Crown Point to remember victims of domestic violence, especially kids. And it's always pretty well attended. It's kind of neat.
And we kind of focused here on the DCS, because that's one of the agencies within the state government that deals with these issues. But the overall umbrella of the Family and Social Services Administration comes into play here, too. And I imagine you probably have a role that you have with the overall FSSA, don't you?
Absolutely. Actually, the mental health side of the shop for us is clearly the largest. Mm-hmm. We've got a total of about 850 employees, a budget of a little over $90 million a year. We treat somewhere between 14 and 16,000 people a year, depending on what's going on that particular year. And we do everything from providing substance abuse care. We have a drug-assisted therapy program that we provide there, a lot of therapy for folks with mental illness situations and substance abuse issues. We do a lot of community development. We have a prevention program that also operates out of the Gemini site that does things like tobacco cessation. It runs support groups for LGBTQ kids. We do a suicide prevention support group. We do a lot of things like that. So FSSA and us are very good partners.
Mm-hmm. Now, if anybody would like more information about the services that the regional health systems can offer, all of the services, and we're not just talking just about the mental health side, but also about the Geminis child care side as well, too. Where can they find out more information?
Probably the best thing to do is to check us out on the website, and it's regionalhealthsystems.org. Mm-hmm. And in there we have tabs that can get you to either Geminis or Regional or our third corporation, which is Lake Park Room Board and Assistance Program.
Well, it sounds like a lot of operations come under one big umbrella, it sounds like, and it all comes under the Regional Health Systems umbrella, to be sure. And, Bob, thank you for spending time with us to talk about not only about the expansion, which is probably well worth noting.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.